Hello and welcome everybody to the Rest of History bonus episode. And Dominic, we are aglow with historical metaphors right now, aren't we? Because we are recording this having just done two episodes of what is turning out to be a six-part series on the Titanic.
Yes.
So there's been a lot of
icebergs, metaphors, hubris, disaster. Yeah. So the original plan was to do two episodes on the Titanic to give subscribers some sense of how the rest of history works. We were going to do two episodes. We thought it would just about stretch to two. And then we did the notes.
No, we did the reading. We did the reading, didn't we?
Yeah.
And not even the reading, the research.
Yeah.
So I went to Belfast.
You did? On the ground research, Tom.
On the ground research, which we don't do very often, and was gripped. And then we've both been reading a brilliant book by Richard Davenport Hines, Titanic Lives. And I've read a fantastic book by Francis Wilson, How to Survive the Titanic, which is about J. Bruce Ismay, who is the guy who runs the White Star Line. And who notoriously gets into a lifeboat and survives, becomes vilified for his supposed cowardice. But anyway, we've just got completely carried away. It's such a fascinating story, completely gripped.
It's a brilliant story, isn't it? And actually, Theo wants everybody to know, because he's a hate figure because he restricts the length of the bonus episodes. He wants people to know that he encouraged us. Well, at first he said, why don't you stretch it to three? And then when we said, you know what, actually it might be looking like a five or a six, his face fell and he said, this is the last time I ever tell you to stretch a series.
Yeah. I mean, this is what comes of feeding the beast.
Yeah, you feed the beast, but the beast's appetite never...
voracious.
Yeah. So probably as a result of that, for people who've been waiting for Fall of Singapore, that episode will be a bit delayed because we have to do the Titanic ones, but we will come back to Singapore hopefully a little bit later this year.
But we might have an episode on something east of Suez, mightn't we, in the form of the first Chinese emperor.
Exactly.
Which we were discussing doing.
And we have some real treats coming up before Titanic, which are, of course, chocolate and monkeys. So quite a range, I think it's fair to say, Tom.
And then after Titanic, we have Luther.
Yes.
Which I know you're looking forward to, aren't you, Dominic?
Yeah, I'm genuinely looking forward because I don't know that much about Martin Luther. I know that he threw a dog out of the window, isn't it? Something like that.
Yeah, and he's a Playmobil character as well.
He's a Playmobil character. Well, we have a Playmobil Luther, actually. We used to do Wars of Religion.
Did you?
Yeah. Protestants always won.
Right.
Like in real life. Right.
Yeah, which takes us back to the Titanic.
Exactly.
Part of what was fascinating was realizing how deeply embedded it was in the sectarianism of pre-First World War Ireland.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story, isn't it?
Absolutely fascinating. So, any other excitements, Dominic, before we get on to the questions?
I reviewed a brilliant book, actually, at the weekend, which I'll recommend to the listeners, those people who don't read the Sunday Times. It is called Little Englanders by Alwyn Turner, and it's about the Edwardians. And so it's actually the period of Titanic.
Does the Titanic feature?
He does mention the Titanic. It's all about the music hall and the popular culture and all these fraudsters and rascals. The fat boy of Peckham. Are you familiar with him, Tom?
No.
He was like a 25-stone, 10-year-old child who was exhibited right on the stage.
And had he been deliberately fatted up by his parents?
I think he had. And there was a sort of, vogue for very fat children to be exhibited.
And very thin as well, weren't there? The kind of very thin people would also.
Yeah. They loved all that, the Edwardians.
Bearded women.
Yeah.
And then in due course, the Rector of Stewkey.
Yeah.
Which, of course, we're going to do an episode on, aren't we? Because you promised me.
It was a seaside attraction, wasn't he, Tom?
And he ended up being eaten by a lion.
Yes, he did indeed. Sorry, this is meaningless to most people listening to this. So we've got some questions, I believe, Tom?
Yes, we have. So this is coming off the back of our series on Britain in 1974.
Mm.
I'd be interested to know, our non-British listeners, whether you enjoyed them, whether you just ignored them, whether you felt it was perhaps too British-focused.
Well, just to be clear, Tom, if they do think that, we don't care. Oh, certainly I don't care.
No, it's just you are so brilliant on it. And I enjoy doing them so much that I would love to do more on that.
Yeah.
But equally, you know, we don't want to seem too Anglocentric. But I so enjoyed doing them. I thought they were such fun. Anyway, here is a question from Athelware. And this is for you, Dominic. One of the more intriguing plots in The Crown.
Yeah.
So that's the Netflix series about the Queen. Was the notion that Lord Mountbatten was invited to lead a coup against Harold Wilson. Is there any truth to this? So Lord Mountbatten was the last Viceroy of India.
Was.
He was Commander-in-Chief of Allied Forces in...
Burma.
Anyway, he was a very significant figure.
Yeah.
And he is something to do with the royal family, and I can't quite remember what it is.
He's Uncle Dickie, isn't he? He's somebody's uncle.
King Charles's? I don't know. Anyway.
His relation to Prince Philip, isn't he?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's what it is.
Anyway, we're not the rest is royalty.
In my childhood, he was very much a kind of, you know, a hero.
Yes, killed by the IRA.
And it was felt that he'd done very well in India. I think opinion on that has now slightly changed.
Yes.
Yes, and then he ends up being blown up by the IRA, doesn't he? So what's the background to this coup story? Do you know?
So this is an earlier coup.
So many coups.
So this is in the late 1960s, I think 1968, because it's after the devaluation of the pound. Because I wrote about it in a previous book called White Heat. This is in the previous Harold Wilson government. And a guy who is a sort of newspaper magnate or would-be newspaper magnate called Cecil Harmsworth King, who ran the Daily Mirror. It's a sort of early version of the coup rumors that you get in 1974. So Cecil Harmsworth King, he's a megalomaniac, and he thinks Harold Wilson is running Britain into the dirt, has made a terrible mess of things. And he, Cecil Harmsworth King, in his desk at IPC headquarters, which is the Mirror company, he has a list in his desk of all the people that will be in his cabinet, like a sort of fantasy cabinet, like a daydream. And he decides that the person to lead this should be Lord Mountbatten.
Because he looks good in a uniform or?
Yeah, because he respects him. He's a sort of...
He's a national hero, that kind of thing.
National hero, exactly. He goes to have lunch with Lord Mountbatten. And Mountbatten has a scientific advisor called Sir Solly Zuckerman.
That's so 60s, isn't
it? Very 60s.
A top boffin.
Yeah. And Solly Zuckerman is there, and Cecil Harmsworth King says to him, listen, Dickie, things have gone too far. Wilson government's got in a mess financially. It's time to step in. Time to have a national government. You should take over. Go and see the Queen. Tell her. Because there's a slight assumption, I think, still in the 1960s that the Queen and Philip are basically Mountbatten's puppets and that he can boss them around and tell them to do whatever he wants. So Cecil King says to Mountbatten, you know, just go in and say, look, enough's enough. Kick out Wilson. You take over the head of a national government. And Zuckerman said to Mountbatten, Dickie, this is rank treason. We shouldn't sit here and listen to this. And they actually kind of walk out or something. So Cecil Harmsworth King then went back to the Mirror and he ran a front page in the Mirror saying, enough is enough. You know, time for Wilson to go, time to have a national government. But obviously he lacked a figurehead. And everyone just laughed at him and said, you've gone mad. And the Mirror actually kicked him out. The other directors kicked him off the board or something.
So it wasn't really much of a coup.
Mountbatten had no interest in it whatsoever.
Because I'd always had the vague sense that he was more interested in it than that. Now I learn I was wrong. So that's good. I've learned something.
I mean, literally, he thinks about it for 90 seconds. You know, I mean, I have no doubt that actually in his club, what club would he have been in? I don't know, the Army and Navy club or something.
Boodles.
Yeah. Whites. In his club, Mountbatten, I'm sure he's sitting, you know, in the billiard room or something saying, oh, bloody shower this government, you know, we should kick him out. And but it's not at all serious. Mountbatten was never going to lead a coup. It was unthinkable.
Okay. So another question.
Yeah. So that's from Kaiser Karina.
He asked, question from the 1974 episodes, will historians 500 or 1,000 years from now look back and view the 1970s as historically distinct from the 1960s? Or will they be overtaken by larger historical arcs and view such micro-historical divisions the way we would see the difference between 1160 and 1170? Is this sort of historical analysis only available to contemporary historians?
Yeah.
I would say absolutely, definitely.
Yeah, totally, totally. He's totally right. So think about the books that I've written, which are covering such tiny periods of time. I find it hard to believe that they'd be of interest to anybody other than real nerds in 50 or 60 years, because it'd be rather like somebody saying, well, here's a book about the last 3 years of the 1860s.
But an incredible resource. I mean, I would love to read like your books on, I don't know, 1869 to 1873 or something. I mean, I'd love it with that kind of detail going into all the popular culture as well.
I mean, I would too, but I don't think most people would. Obviously, right now, for a contemporary readership, that period can bear the weight of attention, because we're really interested in it. But, you know, the differences that seem to us so large between the world of the late 1950s and the world of like the late 1970s seem so different. And the technology, the culture.
Well, just a counterview to that.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think it's possible that we are living through a process of cultural, moral dislocation that people looking back in 100, 200, 500 years might recognize as being quite seismic.
I don't. See, I don't think that. I think actually, to me, you know, that's like thinking that you live through peculiarly interesting times. I don't believe that people in the 23rd century will say, gosh, the 70s and the 60s, so different. I mean, they won't even think about them.
No, they won't say that. I don't think they'll say that. But I think they might say the 60s are interestingly different from the world that went before them. It depends where the process that we're going through now ends up. I mean, if it's nothing, then that's not the case. But it took people are basically kind of a century and a half to realize that they'd been living through something called the Reformation.
Yeah, fine.
It can take time. So it's not until the mid-17th century that people start to enshrine the 1520s as having been the beginning of something really seismic in European history.
I accept that. And I thought you would make that point, to be fair. I'm not saying a predictable time, but I did think you would make that point. I think it's a good point. But I do think, actually, that the idea that that period is a turning point, which is obviously very popular among people who were sort of agents of change, as it were, in the 1960s. They thought they were tremendously important. They wrote books talking about how important they'd been, and they were the first generation to, you know, have sex or whatever. I think so much of that rests on a caricature of the preceding periods. So I think everything that happens in the 1960s and 1970s could have been anticipated, was anticipated in the 1920s, 1930s, if not earlier.
Of course. But I think that, and actually there's a question about this later on, I think that there are trends, not just within Britain, but within all the countries of the West, that are really quite significant that have happened post-war. And the 60s seems quite a convenient
label.
Now, who knows where they will lead? We don't know where they will lead. But if it results in a really comprehensive cultural transformation, then I can imagine that people might look back and remember that. But equally, I mean, we just don't know, because we don't know, you know, whether the West will exist, what status it will have relative to other parts of the world. I mean, I know nothing about what happens in, say, China between 1160 and 1170.
Yeah.
And China's probably, you know, I mean, one of the two most significant countries in the world at the moment, but I just don't know that. So there's a kind of kaleidoscopic effect, isn't there, in influencing what people remember?
I agree. I think, to go back to his question, there are obviously differences that we can identify in previous periods in kind of cultural temperature, in kind of public debate, in the political climate, in the caste even, between different units of time. You know, so there's a point in Britain which is very identifiably high Victorian, Gladstone and Disraeli, you know, that kind of culture, Gilbert and Sullivan, I don't know. And then there's a point which is, we would say, is Edwardian, where the vocabulary is slightly different, the cultural themes are different. Now, we can identify that now because we're 100 years on. And so those things to us look, you know, tangibly different, don't they? You know, if you were watching a drama series, you could identify the difference between a high Victorian one and an Edwardian one, just the way the characters dress and talk and what they talk about. But could we do that from a medieval period? No, obviously we couldn't, could we? I mean, 1240s or 1230s or something.
But the 1060s, definitely, because something crucial happens in 1066 in England.
Right, of course. But by and large, that's not the case.
No, but again, there are certain decades that, for individual countries or whatever, are clearly very significant. You know, the difference between the 1780s and the 1790s. I mean, people, I think, will be conscious of that as something for probably in 1,000 years' time. You know, the first book I wrote about, and I called it Rubicon, because the idea of the Rubicon as a dividing line between two very distinct periods of history. So the 50s BC, the age where the republican system of government in Rome is taken for granted, and then Caesar crosses the Rubicon and you have an age of civil war, which will culminate in the establishment of the Augustan autocracy. I mean, that is quite a significant dividing line, I think. And the sense of those decades being different is important still. So I think it matters. Well, first of all, it matters how seismic the event is in the context of the age, but it also matters how significant that period of history is to subsequent generations.
Agreed. Totally agree. Yeah.
So for instance, one of the things that has changed, I think, since the Second World War is because we have a much less monocultural society now, we need to construct a kind of a new model of what our past in, say, Britain should be. And I think this is true of every Western country where there's been mass immigration. The sense of there being a kind of unitary, accepted story based in the idea of a nation state going back centuries and perhaps millennia, I think that that's become increasingly under threat. And so our sense of what is important in the past, therefore, is changing as well, inevitably.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although I do think that narrative will return. I think the current sense of flux and of kind of disrupting the traditional narrative, I think will itself come to seem unfashionable and a bit tired. You know, that what matters is not Henry VIII and Sir Thomas More, but is the fact that Henry VIII has a black trumpeter. I think people will soon be rolling their eyes at that and saying, come on, let's get back to Sir Thomas More. I personally think the traditional narrative will prove more resilient in the long run, frankly, because it's more interesting. But I agree with you that there are moments where the transition between different episodes, as it were, or different eras, looms very large. I also agree, I think it's a really astute point, that it's not just how it seems to people at the time, but it's how it seems to people 2,000 years later. So there are two perspectives.
Yeah.
But I think that happens
yeah.
at particular fracture points. So your Rubicon period, or let's say the 1910s, the collapse of those empires, Germany, Austria-Hungary, whatever, Ottomans. Those obviously loom very large. But at most points in history, there aren't moments like that, right?
No.
So, you know, for a Roman, if you'd said the 180s and the 190s, or the 170s and the 200s, I mean...
Well, I think it also reflects a notion of there being something called progress, that there's a kind of teleological process in history, that there is a kind of end point that we're moving towards.
Yeah.
Well, we've just been doing the Titanic and this kind of obsession with speed, that things get faster and faster and you get quicker and quicker, bigger and bigger. And that is quite a kind of culturally contingent notion. Most periods in most history in most of the world have not had that. And I think it's probably one of the things that, obviously, I think it derives from a distinctively Christian understanding, but it does get secularized and it fuses with the fact that it's in the West that you get the Industrial Revolution, which technologizes that idea of progress. And it kind of builds in the idea that things will be different decade to decade because they will be getting better or worse, however you want to frame it. But for most civilizations, most parts of the world, that idea would be aberrant. Of course, people are aware that change happens, but
yes, of course,
in general, change is viewed as bad. And so therefore, essentially, you want everything to stay as they are, and your assumption is that they will stay the same.
And also, does that mirror the experience? It's a question that hangs over all historians. How much of the history we write accurately reflect the experience of the majority of the people alive at that point? So I guess the majority of people alive at any point in history, at the end of their lives, if you'd ask them, how much change have you seen? How much are things different? They would probably say, not very much. And I guess that's true of a lot of people, even who have lived through periods of tremendous change, don't you think, Tom?
So just to follow up with a question from Fable Skull, brackets D.
Yes.
Do you think culturally, socially, politically, etc., the last 100 years, say 1920 to 2024, has seen more change in British society than the preceding 100 years, say 1815 to 1920? And we could broaden that out to include not just Britain.
It's the perfect question. And I would say no, shockingly. I think the Victorian century sees more change. Now, lots of people will disagree with that, but I think if you lived in that period, 1815 to 1920, which you could live to 105, you would have seen moving pictures, railways, motor cars, aeroplanes, votes for women.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Industrial Revolution, we've talked about this before, I think it's with the Agricultural Revolution, it's the great turning point in world history. And to live through that, I mean, utterly transformative.
Yeah. Most people in Europe worked on the land. Tens of millions of people grew their own food. The change from that to where people living in cities.
Yeah. Well, from stagecoaches to railways.
Yeah. Stagecoaches to aeroplanes. I mean, that's massive. I think that's bigger than saying, oh, I can carry a television in my pocket. I mean, you know what a television is, just a smaller television.
Yeah.
And of course, the internet and all of that stuff has changed things, but has it changed things for us? Is my life in the last 50 years radically different from the 1970s in a way that absolutely eclipses the changes in the Industrial Revolution or Victorian Britain?
No, I completely agree.
But there's no point before that that you would make that claim, is there? Do you think? In the previous, you know, thousands of years of human history? Surely not. Because most people who ever lived at every point before the mid-19th century were peasants living on the land.
Yeah.
You can say 16th century or printing press or 17th century? Surely not. I mean...
No, there's no period that rivals the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
The period of industrialization, living through the period of industrialization is the greatest change.
Okay.
And for masses of, you know, for millions and millions of people. And it's a process of change that will affect the entire globe,
yeah,
not just one corner of it.
Yeah. Okay, we agreed.
And that is the other thing about whether people say, going back, will people remember the difference between the 1960s in Britain and the 1970s? I mean, I imagine in 1,000 years, I mean, will Britain exist? What status will it have? Who knows? Will people have any interest in it at all?
I think in the same way that 18th century prime ministers, no one's heard of more than about two. The Earl of Bute, the Duke of Newcastle, I mean, absolutely titanic names.
Yeah.
But who cares now? Their stuff seems so trivial and irrelevant.
But it's also, you were inspired to write your series of books on modern history of Britain. Because there were lots of such books about America.
Yeah.
You focused on American history to begin with, but loads of people had written those kinds of books. They hadn't written it about Britain because Britain doesn't matter relative to the United States. So British history for, you know, 400 years has been very significant, not just in British terms, but in European and indeed global terms. That is no longer the case. You have the feeling, I think, if you write about American history, or I guess now Chinese history. I mean, this is what matters. And, you know, in the global context, there are countries that matter and then they cease to matter as much as they did and it goes up and down.
I think it's more complicated than that, though, because I think the stuff that I liked in American history, actually some of that stuff was already out of date. So if you take America's rise to globalism, to wealth, to power, which is kind of late 19th century America, Gilded Age America, I mean, no one reads books about that now, about the presidents of that period. I mean, if you take the stage when Britain is rising to superpower status, so the 18th century, there's an argument, is the great century for Britain. Mm. I mean, Britain is created in the 18th century in 1707. Britain rises to rival France. Britain eclipses France. Do people read books about that? I mean, that undoubtedly matters. I mean, it's shaped so much of the world, but people, because we're too distant and because the political concerns of the time seem too remote. Actually, I think people so often read history either for soap opera escapism or for narcissistic reasons, to see themselves reflected back.
I agree. I mean, I think that the relative power of a country geopolitically, I mean, it doesn't guarantee that the history is going to be any more interesting than the history of somewhere that hasn't impacted at all. I mean, all history is interesting. All history offers you windows onto how people can live.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the fascination of it. But I do think that historians tend to write about, I mean, it's the way it is, dominant frameworks of understanding the world. So I would say, I mean, the way that history is written now reflects the massive ideological preponderance of American culture, for instance. And it's a framing
You're right,
that then influences how the histories of other countries are seen.
Yeah, of course.
Just as in the 18th and 19th centuries, Americans would have been influenced by how British historians understood the past.
Yeah, that's true. It's a fair point.
And so that sense of where the locus of power is, cultural power, and culture is generally reflective of geopolitical and economic power.
Yeah.
It is important.
You're absolutely right, by the way, that people are now trying to write British history as American history. So all the people who were trying to read back migration and racial questions and stuff into British history, that's because they have been Americanized and they're trying to turn Britain.
Well, they've been colonized by America, yes.
Yeah.
But that's inevitable. So if the West gets eclipsed, then I can imagine that, you know, we would start to see the world perhaps through Pacific eyes or whatever. I mean, I don't know. But I just think, you know, we don't know where the world is going. But I think that kaleidoscope is always shifting and influencing how we understand the past.
Okay. All right. Come on. Let's ask one question from Mark K. Because we've been talking a lot about modern history. Let's have a question about the Middle Ages. Mark K wants to know, Tom, what characteristics a medieval monarch needed to be a success? Because you've talked recently about one who was not a success, Richard II, even though he actually thought a lot about being a king and what being a king entailed. So if you were making a list of qualities for a medieval monarch, what would you say were the most important?
I think an ability to get your magnates behind you, and indeed bishops. So as a medieval monarch,
yeah,
you are not a dictator. You know, you do not have the tools that would enable you to run a modern state in the way that dictators did, but also you don't have the ideological underpinnings that would enable you to do that. As a king, you are God's anointed, and therefore you owe a duty to the people that you rule. And so in that sense, you are answerable to them as well as to God. And the people who are in a position to remind kings of that are those who have power. So the reason that Edward III is a great king, I mean, Mark says, other than being a top lad, the reason why being a top lad matters is because by and large, the other magnates are lads as well. So you have to be a lad to bring them along with you. You know, we're talking here in the context of the 14th century, but if you go back to, I don't know, the Anglo-Saxon kings, or broadening it out to the, you know, the Etonian kings in what becomes Germany, or the Frankish kings.
Yes, of course.
The ability to be a gift giver is really important. A good king is a king who lays on a good time, who hosts great feasts, who gives gold. And what the kind of the kingship that you get in the 14th century or the 15th century in Latin Christendom is simply a more sophisticated rendering of that. And if you don't keep them on side, then you are probably going to be in trouble.
Yeah. You need to be a people person, Tom.
Well, you need to be a kind of top people person.
Yes. Okay. So thank you all so much. As always, for those of you who enjoy our live streams, we have a live stream coming up on the 27th of February, don't we? Tuesday evening. So that's very exciting. We don't know what we'll be talking about yet because we haven't decided, but it'll be something that's jolly good fun. We've got chocolate coming up. We've got monkeys. Theo says a 27-episode series on the Titanic. We have Martin Luther, which Tom has been looking forward to since the very early days of The Rest is History. And then something else that you've been looking forward to, Tom. So you're hitting us with back-to-back epics. And then you are going straight into your dream subject,
yeah,
which is the life and times of Lord Byron. And that will be taking us through Romanticism, the Ottoman Empire, Greece. Yeah.
Frankenstein.
Lots of exciting things.
Birth of celebrity. Incest, all kinds of things.
Yes, jolly good. So thank you all so much for your support, and we will see you hopefully the live stream on Tuesday the 27th. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.